You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our virtual event today, the State of the Capital Region 2020. My name is Jenny Schutz. I'm a fellow at Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. I'll be teeing off the program today. We appreciate that all of you have carved out time in between your many, many Zoom meetings and homeschooling and general stress over the state of the world. Today, we're going to have a discussion about what we hope will be an engaging discussion about something that's very concrete and close to home, and hopefully a little bit less depressing than much of the other news in the world today. Specifically, today we're going to talk about some changes in demographics in the capital region that have happened over the last 30 to 40 years. Like most of the U.S., the capital region is getting older. The share of older adults has more than doubled since 1970, and at the same time, the share of families with children has declined. This has some profound implications for things like schools, demand for housing, labor markets. So we're going to explore some of the trends in demographics over the last 30 years, and then we're going to talk about what the policy implications are and how local governments are addressing these challenges. Today's program will start with a brief presentation by Leah Brooks. Leah is an associate professor at George Washington's Trachtenberg School, and she is the director of the Center for Washington Area Studies. Leah is going to begin by giving us the results from a new report on the state of the capital region that focuses on trends in age, demographics, and income in the region. After Leah has finished her presentation, we're going to have a very lively and engaging conversation about the practical implications of this. We have an all-star lineup of panelists. This is going to be moderated by Debbie Chung of WAMU, and we have a terrific set of panelists who can speak to various implications of the program. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Leah, who's going to kick it off with some fun graphs and maps. So everybody get set. We're going to have a terrific discussion. You should have been able to submit questions in advance when you registered for the event. But if you have questions that you would like to pose to the panelists for later on, you're welcome to do that on Twitter, hashtag StateOfCapRegion. And please feel free to follow along and comment as we go. Thanks very much. Leah, over to you.
Thank you, Jenny. And thank you so much to everyone who's logged on for joining us virtually. We hope this was going to be in person, but we're happy to still have this event and hope that you and yours are safe and well during these very unusual times. And before I get started, I also want to say thank you to the Brookings team who do things behind the scenes to make everyone else who appears on the scene or the screen look good. So this report, the State of the Capital Region 2020, a region in an economic and demographic transition, has five co-authors. Jackie Bagley, a non-resident research associate at George Washington, me, Leah Brooks, an economist and professor in the Trachtenberg School at George Washington, Brian McCabe, a professor of sociology at Georgetown, Jenny, who you just heard, a Brookings Fellow, and Stan Boyger, a resident scholar at AEI. Before getting into the meat of the discussion for today, I wanted to tell you a few words about the Center for Washington Area Studies at George Washington University. Our mission is to improve the lives of people in the greater Washington area by studying the neighborhoods and communities of our region. We produce policy-relevant research on the capital region and host events for the public on topical issues. And once we're back to having in-person events, we look forward to having you. And please visit our webpage if you'd like to join our mailing list. So this year's report is titled The State of the Capital Region, a Region in Economic and Demographic Transition. We chose this topic because demography can be determinative. Demographics determine the type of services jurisdictions should offer and the revenues that jurisdictions can raise to provide those services. So in writing our report this year, we focus on three economic and demographic features: income, racial composition, and age structure and household composition. In this presentation, I give highlights from income and age distribution. There's much, much more in the report, including a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction breakdown of long-run demographic trends, if that's of interest to you. And we also wrote an addendum with the likely regional impacts of COVID-19. You can find a link to this on our webpage. Here are the definitions of urban, suburban, and exurban that we're going to use throughout. In dark blue, you can see Washington, D.C., Arlington, and Alexandria. These are what we call the urban jurisdictions. In light blue, you see what we call suburban jurisdictions. These are Maryland's Montgomery and Prince George's County, as well as Falls Church, Fairfax City, and Fairfax County in Virginia. And then the green parts and the rest of the picture are what we define as the exurbs. Prince William and Loudoun counties in Virginia are the largest of these jurisdictions in population terms. And now I'm turning to our first highlight, describing how the income distribution in the Washington region has changed. So this picture shows the income distribution across neighborhoods in 1990. The median income in 1990 was about $90,000 in 2018 dollars. One quarter of households, the section on the left of the graph, earn less than $70,000. The top earning one quarter of households earn more than $120,000. And now I'm going to move these numbers up to the top so you can keep 1990 in mind as I add 2018. So this is the income distribution in 2018. The median income in 2018 is just above $100,000. That means that the median income from 1990 to 2018 has grown by slightly more than $10,000. Now, the lowest earning one quarter of households earn less than about $74,000, and that's a slight increase, as you can see, from 1990. What's notable, though, is the top earning households. So the one quarter of households earn above $140,000. That's about $20,000 more relative to that same group in 1990. So in other words, in 2018, relative to 1990, we see a smaller middle class, so that hump in the middle of the income distribution has fallen, and we also see more wealthier households. And you can see that from the line, the distribution line at the right, lifting up. And the bottom line here is that the region's income distribution is spreading out, not because regional residents are getting poorer, but because some residents, not all residents, are becoming wealthier. So let's turn to age. This graph shows the share of residents age 59 or over in urban, suburban, and exurban jurisdictions, as we defined at the beginning. So in 1970 and 1980, urban jurisdictions had inarguably the largest share of the oldest residents at about 15%. But when we look from 1980 to 2000, as we do in this picture, this ranking changes. Suburban and exurban areas increase their share of the oldest residents, while urban areas decrease their share. And now we follow these lines to the present. So as of today, all regions have a substantially larger share of population in the 59-plus age group relative to 1970. The suburbs now have the largest share of those 59-plus at just under 20%. So the bottom line here is that age distribution matters tremendously for the type of jurisdiction services jurisdictions may need to provide and the type of housing they would like to incentivize. And our panel is going to speak to some of this today to put some of these findings in context. For our last highlight, we're showing the other end of the age spectrum, kids. This slide is showing you a map of neighborhoods colored by the share of children under 18. And the darkest purple here are areas with the greatest share of children, as you can see by the legend at the bottom. And one feature that springs pretty immediately visually out of this graph is the kid belt that you can see outside the center of the region for the most part. To get a better understanding of where that kid belt actually is, I'm going to zoom in to the urban and jurisdiction area, urban and suburban jurisdictions that are outlined here in white. Those are going to appear here at the right. So the first thing to note from the zooming in is that most of those areas with very high shares of children are outside of the urban and suburban jurisdictions. They're in the exurbs. However, there are some areas in these urban and suburban jurisdictions with large shares of kids. And you can see them in Southeast Washington, D.C., Southern Fairfax County, and Northern Montgomery County. But what you really want to know, and why you're here today, is what do these trends mean for policy? And that's what we have the panel to talk about. But here are a few issues, just to tee them up, that are salient. And the demographics we've discussed really lay the groundwork for policy. So first, a greater range of income, like we have now in the Washington region, may make political consensus more difficult. Aging, which we also have in the greater Washington area, implies fewer entry-level workers and demand for more accessible housing and neighborhoods. And a declining share of children, another feature we have in the greater Washington area, and kids in different locations now than they used to be, also has implications for services. So we may have demand for schooling where there may be no schools, and less demand for schools where schools already exist. In last year's report, we showed that the region is building predominantly single-family housing. And this graph here shows the nature of new housing units built by the number of units in each housing structure. So what this graph was showing you is that both before and after 2000, the vast majority of housing units built in the region were and are single-family. That's that big bar at the top. The dark purple was built 2000 and after. Lighter purple is built 2000 and before. But regardless of the time period, those housing units are prominent. Housing units are predominantly single-family. We've seen some changes over time in the composition of multifamily units. So a shift from smaller multifamily structures, those from 2 to 4 and 5 to 19, up to structures that have more than 50 units. And households of different types and ages demand different types of structures. So it's important that what the region builds and what the region's jurisdictions allow to be built is aligned with demand. So to help us think about all of this, we are delighted to have a fantastic panel. Our moderator is Debbie Truong from WAMU, where she covers education. She's also written for the Washington Post and the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And she is going to be moderating three fantastic panelists: Jackie Begley, one of our co-authors, a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Washington Area Studies at George Washington University. Jackie is a researcher who has done quite a bit of work on the housing needs of Americans over 65, as well as analysis on housing and demography more generally. Our second panelist is Angie Rogers. Angie is just recently the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for Economic Development in Prince George's County. But she has worn almost every hat in the housing planning world. She's been on the ground providing housing at United Way. She's worked as a consultant on housing issues. And she most recently served as the chief of staff in Washington, D.C.'s Office of the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development. And last but not least, we're getting a perspective on urban education from Dr. Gregory Hutchins, Jr., the superintendent of schools for the City of Alexandria. Gregory has had virtually every possible education job, starting with teacher and ending with superintendent. He is also a true local, not just a graduate of Alexandria's T.C. Williams High School, but also the prom king. And if any of the rest of you on this webpage had anything half as exciting on your bios, I would have put that in as well. So we are thrilled to have all of you come together to talk about what these long-run trends in income, age, and racial composition mean for the Washington area. Go forth. Thank you, Jenny.
Just waiting for everyone to come on. Okay. Thank you all again for taking the time to log on to our panel today. As Leah and Jenny mentioned, my name is Debbie Truong. I'm with WAMU. Our panel discussion today will focus specifically on the aging population and what that means for policy. And then later on in our program, we'll move on to audience questions. Jackie, do you mind just starting off by talking about what's really driving the aging population, what factors are older residents who've lived here for quite a long time and raised families simply staying put, or are there other factors at play?
So yes, I think your hypothesis is right, that we have an aging population in the US in general, and most households typically stay in place as they age, right? So the AARP has shown that older adults want to age in place. Mobility in the US is declining across all age groups, and older adults are much less likely to move than other age groups. So what we're seeing is just a natural aging of the population and people staying in put. Homeowners are much less likely to move than renters. And a lot of these areas where we're seeing the aging population increase, particularly the suburbs, are predominantly homeownership neighborhoods. So that's a big part of it.
Okay. And as the population gets older, what types of services and housing will jurisdictions need to accommodate the older population?
So I think about this in a number of ways. So the AARP basically lays out 8 categories of things that communities need to think about. I'll make it more brief and just talk about 4 or 5 more generally. So the first is thinking about the accessibility and age-friendly factors within the housing stock. So whether or not specific units are age-friendly, and then whether or not there's more options in the community for people who want to downsize. So if there are accessible, if an individual household or housing unit isn't accessible, maybe there's other options in the community for them to downsize into that may be accessible and age friendly. And then the other factors are things like the infrastructure in the community. So whether or not a community is pedestrian friendly, there's public transportation options, what the healthcare resources are like, the community groups, community services geared towards older adults. And then also really important in this is, affordability, right? So is the housing stock affordable? Does the community provide programs that allow for property tax relief or utility cost relief? Does the community offer, or the state offer, incentives or subsidies that allow you to maintain your home, put in the improvements and modifications that will allow you to have an age-friendly home, basically.
Sure. And we saw in one of the slides that the region mostly has single-family homes. Is that the type of housing that is suitable or favorable for older residents? And if not, what type of housing is, and does the region have a large enough supply of that?
So it depends, right? So single-family homes may be great for aging in place. The things that most guidelines, universal design guidelines, tell you to look for are things like no-step entries, whether or not there's a bedroom and a bathroom on one floor, so you don't have to go upstairs within your homes. Whether or not the bathroom, the hallways, the kitchen is modifiable so that you can use a wheelchair if you need to. What does the lighting look like? Things like that. So you could be in a single-family home and be fine, but in other places that would be great would be an apartment building with an elevator. Denser housing in pedestrian-friendly communities are also, typically the neighborhood and the housing tends to be more age-friendly. Unfortunately, though, across the U.S., most housing is not aging accessible. So just last week, the Census put out a study looking at the age-friendly factors within the U.S. housing stock, and they found that only 10% of housing right now, it has enough features. So including things like a no-step entry and a bedroom and a bathroom on the first floor that allow someone to be basically age in place. And they did break it out by region, and they showed the Mid-Atlantic region is even worse, with only 6% of housing units actually appropriate for aging in place right now. And then on top of that, there was a study a few years ago from NYU that showed that the new housing that's built since 1990 is no more likely to be accessible than older housing. So we haven't really been modifying what we build, even if as we start to build and become more aware of these issues. We're not really changing what we build. So it's time. It's time for us to start thinking about this more critically.
Okay. And Angie, the report says that the population is aging most rapidly in the suburbs. Can you talk a little bit about what this looks like in Prince George's County and how the county is planning for the aging population?
Sure. Prince George's has for many years been the sort of bedroom community, considered to be the bedroom community for a bedroom community for Washington, D.C., mostly single family homes, townhomes. But there's been, I think, sort of three major pieces of work over the past few years that are really going to set us up to meet these demographic changes that we've been talking about and that will have many benefits that will be familiar to all the smart growthers out there, but will also serve to make us more age friendly. We did something that's called the Prince George's 2035 plan, which set five priority areas for transformation around five of our metro sites, metro stations. So Largo Town Center, New Carrollton, Prince George's Plaza, Branch Avenue, Suitland. And the vision for those stations and eventually others is for us to have more dense development around those metro stations. So more of those apartment buildings, including so elevator buildings that will be more accessible, a more accessible housing type than housing that we have spread throughout the rest of the county. We also, the other big piece of work has been the county's zoning rewrite, which is setting the stage for us to actually produce that more dense housing in certain areas of the county. And then the last big piece that we just finished at the end of last year has been the county's new comprehensive housing strategy. One of the interesting things that that strategy highlighted was the need for Prince George's to diversify its housing types. So just sort of making the point that most of the housing in the county was single family housing and then townhouse style housing, and that we needed more multifamily housing to meet the types of households that the county wants to attract and the households that are growing in the county. And so all of these things together, I think, is going to set the county up to really meet the demand of the aging households that this report shows that we're going to see.
Okay. And in Prince George's, are you seeing that there are larger concentrations of older residents living in certain parts of the country or the county, excuse me, versus younger residents? Maybe with families?
You know, I think that that is true to an extent because Prince George's has, you know, as I said, a lot of single family townhomes really concentrated on home ownership, a bigger percentage of homeowners than renters. Then I think naturally that sort of tends toward older homeowners. And then as Jackie said, you know, once, you know, those folks tend to stay put longer and tend to try to grow in their homes. And I think what we haven't had necessarily in the county, you know, if you live in a townhouse like mine, I live in a townhouse in Prince George's County that is three levels. And I am very aware that I will get to a point where I might need to try and sell this townhouse and move to a condo, move to an elevator building. But there isn't a lot of that product in the county if I wanted to stay in Prince George's County to move into. And so that's what I think this sort of next phase of development and what our planning is focused on, sort of giving that other type of product that will help us serve the aging population, but also serves lots of other or the smart growth goals for the county.
Okay, and I want to move the conversation a little bit to schools. Superintendent Hutchings, have you seen in Alexandria, you know, the shifts in the population affect where you're seeing families with school-aged children settling down and living?
Yes, actually, and one, I think I'm glad that you brought the school division to the table for this discussion, because a lot of times schools are left out of the conversation, and we're in a lot of cases most impacted by demographics. And what we're seeing in the city of Alexandria is we're seeing a greater number of singles and young people, late 20s, early 30s. And we're also seeing a growth in our younger families. And over time, that's going to have an impact on our enrollments. What we've been seeing in just the past 10 years in Alexandria is a huge increase in our student population. We are over capacity in almost all of our schools at this time. We're building schools in over the next 10 years to accommodate the growth that's happening at a very rapid pace. And I think what we're seeing or experiencing is that more families are choosing to stay in Alexandria after their children get older. We used to see more of our families, or we would see a decline. I don't know if they actually left the city of Alexandria or not, but we would see a decline in our middle school enrollment. So a student would be consistent from kindergarten through fifth grade, and then we would see a drop in our student enrollment in middle school. And now we're starting to see that that's remaining constant, which is contributing to our growing numbers at the elementary and secondary level.
Yeah, and I think I saw in the report that, unlike the region as a whole, Alexandria saw a slight growth in families with children since 1980, while the population of older residents has also grown. Does the fact that both of these things are happening at the same time, that the population is getting older and that there are more families with school-aged children, make it even more challenging to plan for schools?
Yes, it does. It makes it a lot more complicated. In some cases, it does give us a good tax base, which is helpful to the school division. But it does bring some complications along. A lot of people you'll see, in Alexandria, right now our population is, as a whole, as a city, is about 160-something thousand. But our school division, we only have 16,000 students. People would expect for our school division to be a lot larger with the population that we have in our city. But we haven't had a history of having a lot of school-aged children in the city, but that trend is changing, and it's changing pretty rapidly. As a superintendent, I get to feel it every day.
Okay. And has this created any sort of challenges for building schools or finding the real estate to build schools?
Yeah, I think one of our biggest challenges in the city of Alexandria is that, we're not like the suburbs, even though we call ourselves like a suburban urban feel, right? But we're not like the suburbs with a lot of land. So we don't have a lot of places to grow. We've had to be very innovative with our approaches to our growth. For example, we opened an elementary school last year that used to be an office building that was converted into an elementary school because we didn't really have any land to go build a full elementary school. So now we have, a six-story building where the first four floors are an elementary and the fifth and sixth floor are going to be spaces for our central office. And then also with our high school, we're one of the largest high schools in the Commonwealth of Virginia, probably one of the largest in the country, at least in the top 10. We have 4,000 students at our high school right now. We're projected to have 5,000 over the next several years. And we're embarking on what we're calling a connected high school network, where we're going to keep one high school, but we're going to have multiple campuses to provide services for our students throughout the city of Alexandria.
Debbie, if I could just break in and say, even though we don't have the problems that of space that Dr. Hutchings referred to, we are still looking at some of the same opportunities of co-location, since the point for us is to try and have some of our TOD areas act more like and look more like the inner ring. So look more like TOD areas in DC, Arlington, Alexandria. That some of those same things also apply to us, even though we have the space
further out to kind of spread out a little bit more. We're focused on maximizing density on co-location in TOD areas.
Can I add something too? I wanted to say, just point out that from a universal design standpoint and from an age-friendly community standpoint, oftentimes the things that parents with kids want are the same things that older adults want, as far as, you know, denser areas, better transit, sidewalks, parks, you know, a lot of things that make a community livable are universal and not just focused, not just for older people. Everyone wants them. So there's definitely some place complementarities and across both ends of the demographic spectrum.
Okay. Can you think of any places in the Washington region that have done this particularly well, provided that density that's appropriate for older residents and families too?
Well, so, you know, there's a number of communities in DC, the DC region, that have, you know, age-friendly AARP, WHO, the global network, I guess they're part of it. I'm not sure exactly what they're certified as part of it. And those are Alexandria, Arlington, DC, I think Montgomery County. And so we talk about this a little bit in the report. The AARP sort of ranks communities based on a number of things like housing affordability and transit and community networks. And those communities all tend to have good scores. And so they're doing things really well, but then, you know, the flip side of it is they're less affordable than other areas. So it's really hard to get every piece of the puzzle right. And I think it's a good sign that a lot of communities are working towards this.
Yeah, Jackie, I'm glad you brought up the affordability issue, because that is the big piece of it for us too. I think as we think about how to transform some of our communities in Prince George's to look more like those in DC, Alexandria, Arlington, the sort of affordability of those areas, the continued affordability of those areas remains a concern, and the need to get good tools in place to be able to preserve that affordability for all families, but, you know, particularly for our elderly households that have an adult with disabilities. When we think about our housing programs, when we think about public housing, when we think about folks who consume vouchers, we know that if a head of household is elderly or has a disability, they are likely to need that subsidy, you know, long term, if not permanently. And so along with sort of rethinking our physical spaces, Prince George's has really got to think about the tools that we have in terms of preserving affordability, preventing displacement, as we look for our areas to grow in the way that other areas in the region have grown, which is going to make them more desirable and is going to make them more affordable, more unaffordable if we don't have the right tools in place.
Yeah, I think one of the things...
I was just going to say, I just wanted to add on to what Angie was saying. Just a quick comment is that I think, you know, it is very complicated to try to continue to be attractive and then to also have that affordable housing component or mixed income properties and things of that nature. And that also has an impact on our school and our demographics and our dynamics within the school system. And I know in the city of Alexandria, our city manager, as well as our city council, they have been very adamant on trying to have affordable housing options so that we can still attract, you know, all different types of incomes in the city of Alexandria, but also to maintain those families who may have low income at this time so that we're not forcing them out or gentrifying, you know, certain neighborhoods throughout our city.
Yeah, one of the things that stood out to me in the report is that the share of younger families is larger in the exurbs, and I wonder how much of that has to do with this issue of affordability. And as a follow-up to that, you know, are there policies that jurisdictions could put in place to reverse some of that and bring those families closer into the cities? And is there the political will and also the desire in some of these communities to do that? That can go to anyone.
So I'll start. I'm certainly not the expert on this, but you know, from a housing perspective, you know, I have long believed that those families choose the exurbs for a number of reasons, and affordability is certainly one of them. But I think that's relative, like it's affordability plus sort of housing quality and size of housing that you can get. I think that some of our jurisdictions closer in for a long time had issues with the quality of the schools in their communities, or the perception of quality. And so I think there's been probably a number of things sort of driving families to the exurbs. But families are now coming back. For a variety of reasons. I think the quality of life, as if I think about, you know, where I was in DC, the quality of life in a lot of DC neighborhoods has changed over the years. And so that draws families back in. So I think there's a number of reasons that maybe sort of, you know, was driving folks out to the exurbs, and then a range of reasons that are driving people back in. I think the sort of challenge for us, you know, who do the planning in jurisdictions for, you know, how we construct communities, how we plan services, is, you know, going back to what Dr. Hutchings said, can we provide a range of resources, housing types, school choice, et cetera, that meets households across the income spectrum to give people that choice of where they want to live. When we think about low-income households and what we're trying to offer them, often we position it in terms of mobility. Do you have enough resources to be able to make a choice about where you want to be? And what's the best atmosphere for your family? And so for me, it's trying to make sure that we're offering families that so that they get to make a choice.
Okay. Another thing that stood out to me in the report is that it said that as the share of families with younger children goes down, the demand for schools will be less. I'm wondering if you're already seeing that in parts of the Washington region, and if so, where, and what that could mean for the future of these school buildings. Could we see school consolidations, things like that?
Well, I wish we were having that problem in Alexandria, but that's not the case. So we're growing rapidly. I think we are an anomaly in this area, because our student growth is just happening so quickly that we can't even keep up with the amount of growth that's occurring. We can't build fast enough to accommodate the growth. But I was in my former job as superintendent in Shaker Heights, the enrollment was actually declining, and we were having tough discussions around consolidation of elementary schools just to make sure that we were providing you know, the appropriate educational experience, but also being fiscally responsible and not having these large buildings that were built to accommodate like 600, you know, students, but they're at 200, right? It's a waste of some of that space. And we were working through how do we take these old structures and either sell them or repurpose them or use them and lease them out to bring some, or just generate some income into the school division. I know in the city of Alexandria, we had that challenge many years ago when our enrollment was declining, and I wish that we would not have sold so many of our schools, because now we need them, right? So the unfortunate thing is that, you know, there are ebbs and flows in regards to, you know, enrollment and population, and you can be at a point where you're seeing a decline in your base or in your population, and then over a period of time, you see people now more attracted to your city, and it's growing, and you've given up some of those resources that you now need and you're in a dilemma like we are in the city of Alexandria. So I'm just speaking from my perspective and the work that I've done.
Okay. Jackie, have you seen any places in the region that have really sort of suffered from a decline in school enrollment?
I'm not the expert on that. I'm not sure.
Okay. I also wanted to talk about labor. The report also made mention that the fact that you have older folks, there'll be less of a supply for entry-level jobs in particular. Is there concern that an aging population will affect the labor force and cause a decline in supply?
So you mean as far as, you mean just as worker supply in general, right? I think there is some concern about that. I think there's also concern about, people wanting to work as they age and not, and sort of age discrimination in the workforce, or people who don't feel or don't have enough money to retire on, and who want to find a bridge job and work potentially in a different field, maybe in an entry level field, but they just don't have the resources or the marketing is not done the right way to help people, transition across their careers. And I know there's a lot of emphasis on trying to help match like this mismatch between entry level workers and people who want to potentially work after retirement. I don't know enough about all the programs that are out there, but I know this is definitely top of mind for some people who focus on aging and workforce development.
Yeah, I would just add to that, Jackie and Debbie. I mean, obviously in my cluster in Prince George's, we spend a lot of time looking at how the workforce is gonna grow in our county and in what areas it's going to grow in. Particularly for older adults who, might be looking to sort of make a late career change or, that sort of thing, either because of unemployment, which is a big issue now, given COVID-19, I think that there's already a disconnect between how our workforce is going to grow and the skill set of the folks who are just coming out of high school and college, much less our older adults. So if we're looking at the areas that we are going to grow are in healthcare and biotech sort of tech related jobs. I think the sort of prospect of having older adults be prepared to take that on, I think will be a big question. I just wanted to say to your last question about sort of communities that experienced a sort of decline in school population and then a jump back up. And just sort of acknowledge, I'm not an expert on it either, but obviously worked for a long time in D.C. where those dynamics existed and sort of watched this play out in communities that I was working in. And so I just want to acknowledge that it's a difficult conversation and situation that I don't know if anybody quite has the right answer to, like, as communities are transitioning and sometimes as fast as they are, So DC obviously went through this whole sort of period of sort of closing down schools and repurposing them, redeveloping them. And that was horribly dividing for some communities, to the extent that when I was in DC and ran a program that was seeking to redevelop an old elementary school that had closed down 10 years earlier. I mean, the vitriol over, whether we were going to come and redevelop, this parcel that hadn't held a school for 10 years was very high. So I just want to acknowledge that that's a difficult conversation for communities. I don't know if they are good answers for it. I know as someone who is on the inside, we try to track sort of make the best decisions that we can. But communities change, dynamics change. I've seen communities completely transform in the space of 5 years. And so sometimes it's hard to get it right.
And I think that's what makes it, you know, a little complicated, because nobody has that crystal ball to show what the future holds. And one thing could happen. I mean, think of what we're in right now, COVID-19, our global pandemic. I mean, who would have ever predicted that we would be in this situation where we're practicing social distancing and social gathering guidelines and being kept at home, you know, and not being able to go into our offices and out into our communities. And that can have an impact on our populations, especially our overpopulated areas, because people may now be concerned about being in an overly populated city or community, and they may migrate to, you know, a more rural area, which we might see as a trend, you know, over time, just from this pandemic. So these are things that we're going to have to really be prepared for. I also just wanted to put in just a quick comment in regards to how we're preparing the next generation of workers. I think Angie, she touched on this a little in regards to like trying to prepare this next generation with biotechnology and the healthcare. In Alexandria City Public Schools, you know, with our high school project, one thing that we are really focused on is multiple pathways for our students to become the next generation of workers. You know, they're going to be the next generation of keeping a stable economy, you know, in this country. And we're going to have to make sure they're equipped to have, you know, the appropriate skills to go out to do things that we don't even know about, that don't even exist today, which is very challenging when you're trying to sell, you know, for me as a superintendent, or at least talk about these careers that really don't exist. And parents are like, well, I never heard of that. And that's how much money are they going to make doing that? You know, but 10, 20 years ago, we didn't know about iPhones, right? And look at it now, everybody's going out to get their iPhone 11. So, I mean, I just think these are things that we are going to have to just trust, you know, some of our futurists who are talking about what the world could be in the future, and take it into consideration when we're making these major decisions about, you know, whether it's neighborhood planning or talking about what the future of our education is going to be.
And thank you for bringing up the impacts of COVID-19. Superintendent Hutchings, how will this pandemic affect, you know, planning in Alexandria schools for the future, for the fall, in terms of just anything from remote learning to building needs and things like that?
Yes. So it's going to have a significant impact, you know, on our school division. I really think that it's going to have an impact on public education in general. And I've been saying this time and time again, you know, we didn't have it right in public education prior to this global pandemic. Many students' needs were not being met across this country. There were several inequities in regards to schools. So it is our responsibility to use this pandemic, that once we get through this, that we don't go back to how things were, because we were missing a lot of children. And now we know that it is possible to do this distance learning, which I have to say in Alexandria, we've been able to transition really quickly from our traditional learning environment to a distance learning environment. We were one of the first school divisions in the Commonwealth of Virginia to have a one-to-one technology devices for our kids. So all of our students in grades 3 through 12 already had devices. Teachers were already used to doing online learning through Canvas, which is a platform that we use to communicate with our students. So it was a smooth transition for us. However, it's still not replicating what they were getting in a face-to-face instruction or instructional environment. So academic loss comes from that. You know, even our kids who have, you know, both parents are in high incomes and have all the supports that they need are experiencing some form of loss because they're not having the opportunities to be in a classroom and the interactions that they were accustomed to having prior to the pandemic. You know, as we move into this new fall year, there are several things that we're gonna have to keep into consideration. If we're gonna have to live up to the social gathering guidelines and the social distancing guidelines, that is gonna have an impact on our transportation and how many students are gonna be able to be at a bus stop or on a bus, how many students could be in a classroom or in the cafeteria or transitioning in our halls. So it is going to have a significant impact on what our schools look like in regards to operating. And we're looking at four specific models for the fall. One is a traditional opening of school, which most likely will not happen. You know, I'm optimistic, I'm hopeful. I'm not a believer that in the fall we're going to be able to go back as things as normal. I just don't think that's going to be possible. Two, we're going to have to look at two specific hybrid scenarios, one being 50% of our students returning back in some capacity on any given day. So that means half of the kids in a building at a time, and we would have to work through what that hybrid approach would look like and what those staggered schedules and distance learning plans would look like. And then also another hybrid approach that looks at about a 25% population or student population in our buildings and what that approach could look like in our schools. And then the fourth area or fourth model that we're going to be looking at is continuing to be 100% online. So these are some specific, you know, things that we are going to have to work through in this region. I work very closely with our region superintendents. We meet every week and we're having collaborative discussions around how we can, you know, work through the opening of school together versus having individual openings because our employees live all over the DMV. So a decision I make could have an impact on Fairfax or Arlington. So we're trying to be more collective and collaborative with this fall planning, but more to come really soon.
And when it comes to planning, not only for the fall and for learning, how closely do you work with folks in the city's, you know, housing department? What do those conversations look like?
Yeah, so we work really closely with our housing department for a number of reasons. It helps us to do our enrollment projections and to determine what projects will need to be included in our capital improvement program. We also work with them on incentives to get our future employees into the city of Alexandria. You know, the cost of living here is very expensive for some, especially people coming into the field of education, where, you know, we're not millionaires in this field, even though we deserve $1 million, you know, in a salary. But we are working with our housing department just to ensure that we have incentives, whether it is, you know, free months for certain apartment complexes within our within our city, or some really special financing if you're trying to purchase a home in the city of Alexandria. So we work with our housing department in that area as well.
And Angie, how closely do you work with schools when you're thinking through planning?
So I think same thing, very closely. I think particularly as we are thinking about how we use space in our jurisdiction, that the joint conversation there is important, and how we use space in relationship to housing our population, educating our population, but also then providing recreational opportunities for kids and then for people of all ages. I will say that the sort of the glue for us in Prince George's, and it was the same when I was in the DC's deputy mayor's office, is a good, strong planning department that is drawing the links between all of these different needs that a jurisdiction has. And so we really depend on our planning department to be the glue between schools and housing, between schools and recreation, et cetera, to help us plan for what it takes to create vibrant communities that are meeting our residents' needs. And really depending on them to sort of lay that path out for us. So shout out to planners.
Sure. I'm going to move on to some questions that were submitted online. So given that the region is aging and that there's higher mortality, is the region planning for measures that would bolster care for elderly residents, like more training for home health care providers, things of that nature?
I would say absolutely in that area. And I know Angie had touched on this earlier when she talked about the health care professionals as well as biotechnology. You know, right now we are really preparing the next generation by offering all of those certification programs through our career and technical education in Alexandria City Public Schools. And many other school divisions are doing that across this country because we know that there is going to be a need for more nurses, especially as we're looking at this pandemic. I mean, we're going to need nurses, doctors. And I just hope that people now have a passion to go into this work. Yes, we're experiencing this global pandemic. It probably won't be our last, you know, so we need to be prepared to deal with what the future may hold, as well as what some of the implications from what we're going through right now with our global pandemic will have to offer. But in Alexandria City Public Schools, we are definitely providing multiple opportunities for the healthcare profession. And we have a partnership actually with the George Washington University to make sure that we're bringing some of the best and brightest health professionals into the world over the next 10 years.
And I will just add to that. I think all of that is the same for us as well. I'll add sort of from a resources perspective, one of the things that we knew we needed already, and this is also the same in the jurisdiction that I just came from, is the need for more assisted living, more sort of opportunities for folks to age in place, whatever that means in terms of programs that and funding that could support them to do that. So that had already been identified as a need for us and something that we need to focus on in the future. The thing that I think that COVID also has highlighted for us, maybe something that I wouldn't have experienced when I was on the DC side, was the amount of attention that we as a county pay to assisted living and nursing homes as opposed to sort of what gets done at the state level. And I think one of the things that COVID has highlighted for us is the need and the desire for us to be closer to the quality and availability of those places going forward in the future. And so I can imagine that that is something that also we'll want to pay attention to, make sure that we've got the right workforce there to serve those places, to Dr. Hutchings' point. But that's definitely going to be a focus for us going forward.
Okay. And I thought this was an interesting question. As the population ages, is it safe to assume that instances of ageism will also increase? And what can jurisdictions do to prepare or combat that?
I'm not an expert in that area, but you know what I will just say, and this is just from the educator's point of view, you know, age is wisdom, and age brings wisdom, and I think that it is important for us to definitely provide opportunities for us to bring some of that wisdom into whether it's organizations or jobs in the profession. You know, people today, and I think of my mom and my family members who are older than I am, they're working well into their 60s and 70s, and they're loving it, right? They're living their best life. I know my mom is living her best life right now in her 60s, and I think that it's wonderful that we're seeing this next generation of what we call, you know, our senior citizens, which, you know, my mom says, I'm not a senior citizen. I'm just an older person with a lot of wisdom, right? That, you know, they have a totally different perspective on life and what they want for themselves. You know, it's not how it was, you know, many years ago where you reach 60 and you're ready to retire and to kind of like just go into the sunset and move to Florida and that type of thing. You know, now people are still having careers or starting new careers and new businesses and taking on new debt. They're buying new homes and cars and things of that nature that just didn't happen previously. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that, you know, in regards to ageism, that we are realizing age is wisdom and we must embrace and bring forth that wisdom in order for us to get to the next level that we all deserve and want to be.
I will echo that. I think that I hope ageism doesn't increase. I think that people are healthier, living longer, more active today than they were in the past. I think, you know, people, our definition of old has changed over time. And in addition to that, the fact that the AARP and the World Health Organization and the New York Academy of Medicine and all these groups are really focused on strategic plans for aging and sort of focusing on all age communities and making sure that stakeholders and community support is there and people's voices are being heard, I think that will really help. So sort of making sure that people aren't isolated or marginalized as the population ages. And I'm really hopeful that like a diversity of ages within a population and planning can help sort of address the needs of all populations and sort of not make one group stigmatized as we all age.
Okay. So I want to answer the question also just from the perspective of, I think I can be an old person talking to other old people. I think I'm old enough for that now. one of the things that I think about a lot is that as aging workers, like we've got to challenge ourselves to keep up because at some point it, you know, isn't acceptable to sort of be in positions of responsibility or be in leadership positions and not sort of know the new technology or, you know, sort of know. There are some things that, you know, I think employers need to be able to take for granted, which means that, you know, we've got to continuously sharpen ourselves. So we're in this sort of environment now, perfect example, where everybody's getting accustomed to Zoom. And some folks are on this kind of platform for the first time during this period and thinking that it's just a thing. And it's like, no, the same platform through different companies has existed for years, definitely more than a decade. And so I think that's the kind of thing when I hear sort of older leaders saying like, well, I don't understand Twitter. I don't know what that is. It's, you know, at some point we've got to challenge ourselves also to keep up because there's going to be an expectation of the workplace to perform on a certain level. And the same that we expect of young people, right? Telling them to step up. We've got to do it for ourselves as well.
Okay. I think that's our time. Thank you everyone for taking the time out of your day to talk with us.
Thank everybody for joining us. So Debbie, thanks for moderating. Jackie, Angie, Dr. Hutchings, we really appreciate you guys taking your time to share your wisdom, even though none of you are old. And thanks to all of our audience members for joining us. Feel free to check out the full report and stay tuned for future events. Thanks, everybody.